everybody please just turn off your mobile phones? Mobile phones. It is with great pleasure that I welcome you all to this special morning to celebrate the 10th anniversary of BINA. BINA is a learning community dedicated to inspiring and educating the wider Sydney Jewish community. Its goal is Jewish wisdom for life, relevant to today's world, offered in a non-judgmental and friendly forum. People of all ages and from all backgrounds attend the classes, which run every day of the week, day and night. Topics covered are as diverse as parenting, Kabbalah, relationships, Talmud, Hebrew reading, self-development, and skills for Jewish living, all from the perspective of Jewish wisdom. The BINA programs include lectures, weekly publications, audio and book library, parenting, pre-marriage, and relationship counseling. This year, BINA celebrates its 10th year, and what started as a small cluster of classes has blossomed into one of Sydney's most successful organisations, renowned worldwide as a first-class source of Jewish education, and it boasts the best-attended Jewish classes in Sydney, with up to 70 or 80 attending the more popular weekly classes. Between 600 and 700 people pass through BINA's doors each week. I speak for myself on behalf of so many others when I say, what an outstanding learning experience this has been for us all. At any given time as we go about our daily activities, one so often meets a fellow student of BINA, and the inspirational exchange of conversation is so heartwarming. And there exists a new perspective with a different focus and a real added dimension to life. For all this, we are truly indebted and so grateful to the BINA team. Rabbi Gerari and Mrs. Dina Gerari, Rabbi Richie Moss and Mrs. Nechama Dina Moss, and a group of part-time educators, Rabbi Yeshua Smukler, Mrs. Renee Mill, Mrs. Rivka Aaron, Rabbi Fuchs, Rabbi Noti Gulgai, and Mr. David Clark. Our deep thanks and gratitude to you all. And may Hashem bless you with good health, wisdom, insight, and strength to be able to continue the amazing work that you do. I saw a quotation so fitting. We make a living by what we get. We make a life by what we give. And now, the topic for today, dealing with teenagers, a survival guide for parents. I would like to introduce the three panelists to you. Rabbi Moss, Sydney born and bred, in touch with the young Jewish crowd, Rabbi Moss is a prolific writer on a broad range of topics, including Kabbalah and relationships. Renee Mill is an occupational therapist and clinical psychologist with 30 years of experience in developing people. One of her passions is enabling women to grow emotionally through the process of Emet, which is emotional maturity established through Torah, a program devised by Miriam Adahan. In her Emet classes, Renee inspires through offering Torah solutions and contemporary psychological methods to life's daily struggles. What distinguishes these classes is that participants learn how to apply the concepts they learn to real-life situations in a practical way. Rabbi Gerari, founder and director of BINA, born in South Africa and educated in the US and Australia, Rabbi Gerari is known as a passionate educator. Whether dissecting a complex page in the Talmud or lecturing on self-esteem and self-development, his classes are well-structured and informative. Everyone who attends his lectures benefit from his educational expertise and caring nature. I now hand you over to the panel. Thank you.
Thanks, Melanie. Thank you, everybody. I was wondering why I was chosen to be on this panel discussing the world of a teenager and how to be a parent of a teenager, being that I'm neither a teenager nor a parent of a teenager. I'm several years out of being a teenager, but I'm still several years off being a parent of a teenager. So what possibly could I bring to this discussion? But I thought there is one thing that I think I can share with you that I have achieved and none of you have achieved. In fact, none of you have even come close to achieving what I've achieved. That one thing is becoming a man. Becoming a man is something that a teenager needs to do if he's a boy. And I've done it, you haven't. So I wanted to share a little bit of insight into what it means to become a man. And I say specifically becoming a man because a girl doesn't have to become a woman. There's a very big difference in the development of a boy and a girl, a male and a female child, in that a girl is a girl, stays a girl, always was a girl, and doesn't have to become anything but a girl. A boy was not one, has to become a boy, and has to become a man. Male identity, manhood, is something that needs to be achieved. Femininity is something that just needs to be kept, protected, and held on to. It doesn't need to be acquired. Let me explain. When a baby girl is born, she's born to her mother. A mother conceives and becomes pregnant with a baby girl, and the girl is eventually born to her mother, which is fine. She was a part of her mother during the pregnancy stage, and she came out of the body of her mother. As a young baby, she feeds from the body of her mother and is completely dependent on her mother for her existence. As she starts to become a little bit self-aware, she looks up to her mother and feels as a part of her mother and eventually wants to be a mummy. As a little infant, a little girl will start to play with dollies and emulate mummy and say, "I'm also a mummy. This is all fine. This is great. This is quite normal." She's on a good path and she'll continue on that path. She'll go from being a baby girl to being a toddler girl to being a little girl, eventually to becoming a teenage girl and blossoming into a woman, and hopefully eventually doing exactly what she always dreamed to be, and that was to emulate her mummy, to be a mother, to be a woman, to be feminine. It's a path that is quite smooth and set out and relatively easy. I say relatively easily, because when you compare that to what a boy has to go through, you have no idea. Let's start from the very beginning. A mother conceives of a child. Did you know that all fetuses begin off as female? That all fetuses, whether the child will be born as a male or female, at the beginning they're all female. They're all little female fetuses. And then, at some stage, around 6 weeks, the female fetus either continues on being a female fetus or gets zapped. Their DNA molecules get rearranged and they become male. None of us know how painful that is. None of us can imagine, and thank God I even can't remember what a person has to go through to go from a female fetus to a male fetus. That what impact that has on the psyche, on the soul of the child, we have no idea. We can only imagine. How would you like somebody coming and playing around with your DNA and changing you around to something else? That is something that's hard for us to imagine. The Talmud recognized this already. Thousands of years ago, the Talmud says that if parents that have conceived and they want a specific gender for their child, let's say you've just had 5 girls in a row and you'd like a boy, so you can pray for the gender of a child. While you're pregnant, you can pray, "I want a boy." But, says the Talmud, you can only pray for the first 40 days after conception. From conception for 40 days, you can pray that it should be a boy. After that, you can't pray anymore because it's happened already. It's been decided. For the first 40 days, it's still negotiable. After that, it's already decided. It's like after a child's being born to pray that it should be a boy. It can't change anymore. So the Talmud recognized that it's those 40 days, the first 6 weeks of pregnancy, that all fetuses start off as female. But the male ones have to go through this wacky transformation and become a male fetus from being a female fetus. That's step number one. As if that's not bad enough, for the next 9 or so months, that male fetus is a part of their mother. Not their father, a part of their mother. The child in Talmudic literature is described as a limb of the mother that is nourished by the food that the mother eats, is an extension of the mother's soul. Until the child is born, they don't have an individual soul. They have a soul, but the soul has not entered their body. They are enlivened by the soul of the mother. And so therefore, motherhood is an experience of having like an extended body almost, as another part of you that is completely a part of you, dependent on you and a part of your soul. That's fine for a little girl, but a little boy spends the first 9 months of their creation as a part of a female, as a part of a woman, a part of their mother. It doesn't happen that the men are born from men and women are from women. So this male child that has just been zapped into being a male child from a female fetus now has to spend 9 months as a part of a woman, being enlivened by a woman and being a part of the identity of and the soul of the woman. And is then born from that woman, born from a woman, connected by the umbilical cord, which has to be cut, and fed from the body of the woman, from the mother. So this male child that has already had this zap has now also been given like a bit of a false identity, of a feminine identity, which is not his really. And so it's necessary in the early years of a boy's life to sever the tie somewhat, to take a step away in their identity from their mother. They can't identify with their mother anymore. Of course, the bond with the mother is there and should be there. But as far as the child's identity, a little boy has to somehow conceptualize himself as a boy, not to disconnect from mother and connect to father, as far as an identity is concerned. So that is not easy. This little child who's being fed by the mother, looked after by the mother, has an innate bond with the mother, has to then connect with a father. And biologically, a father is a distant figure, is a theoretical connection to the child, not nearly as direct as a mother. That is a challenging thing for a boy to do. So when a little boy starts playing with dollies and saying, "I'm a mummy," so we say, no, you're not. You're not a mummy. You're going to be a daddy. And we have to educate that they can't emulate the mummy. So that's another thing that this little boy has to get his head around, that he's one of the boys. He has to feel he's one of the boys, connect to the father, and then become a boy. So that if that works, if it works out that they do bond with their father, identify with the father as being one of the boys, then they have to be accepted by the other boys as well. And so they go to school and you have a bunch of boys. When you have boys together, all of these people struggling for an identity, not quite sure where they were, all trying to be accepted by the boys. If they're a little bit not boyish, if they're not quite as tough or as boyish as the other boys, so then they might be rejected by the boy peers and not feel like one of the boys, which would be a terrible thing. They need to be accepted as one of the boys. But that's only an introductory stage. They're accepted as one of the boys, and once they've become a boy, then they have to become a man. There are fascinating studies that say that there are studies on juvenile delinquency, teenagers who become involved with criminal activity or drugs or other antisocial behaviour, and there is quite a lot of information on it that says that one of the major causes of juvenile delinquency is a lack of passage from boyhood to manhood. It's been identified that the years between 12 and 14, those years are a time when a boy needs to become a man. And becoming a man means that having bonded with his father, he then has to disconnect a little bit from his father and bond with the general man world, be accepted by men, find a mentor, a hero, a role model in the male world that they can look up to, and somebody, whether it be a teacher or a rabbi or a family friend or somebody outside, not their father, somebody else that they can look up to who accepts them and brings them in. If that doesn't happen between the ages of 12 and 14, particularly if they didn't bond with their father in the earlier years and they don't have the boyhood in order to step into manhood, if they don't find that figure, so then they will replace that figure with a gang. where the gang scenario has the same feeling of manhood, where we're men together, there's a leader that tells them what to do, that encourages them, they'll connect to something like that, something like it, like a gang or drug dealers or these type of people who they can feel a part of because they didn't get it from a true leader, from a true hero. They didn't become a man. So it's those teenage years where the boy becomes a man, and if they don't do that, if it doesn't happen smoothly, if they don't find the right role model, the right person to look up to, the right hero for their life, so then their development is arrested, is frustrated, and they're going to find some other outlet, somebody else to be their hero that may not be one that we are very happy with. Of course, then, once they've settled into their manhood, once they've really become a man, they've been accepted by the male world, they've got their hero, and they've really become a man, then it's time to be in touch with their feminine side and to find a woman to live with. Just when they settled into being male, with their male identity, then all of a sudden they have to start finding their feminine side. And in order to enter into a relationship, which ideally is in the 20s and onwards, when they to settle into a relationship, then they have to reverse their entire development, go back on everything that they did, becoming a man, and find that innate feminine side to be able to connect to a woman. None of you have done this, and none of you know how hard it is, how difficult it is, that every stage is such a big transition, such a big development, such a big change that a boy has to go through. Every single stage, and if at any stage of this little passage, if at any one stage things don't go quite right, if it doesn't quite happen, meaning if the baby boy is not able to separate somewhat from the mother, and remains too attached to their mother and too identified, too entangled with their mother, so then that's going to arrest the development. If they don't then attach to their father and connect to their father and become one of the boys, become an accepted boy, so then that's going to be another hiccup in their development. And then even if they get through all that but they don't become a man, they're not accepted in the world of manhood, so then that is going to again arrest their development. I think it's incredible that in Jewish tradition, these stages of development are recognized and are ritualized, that we have traditions and rituals to actually recognize these stages of development exactly. Starting off with the bris, that when a boy is given a bris, so indeed they're 8 days old, they may not be consciously aware of what's going on, but definitely subconsciously there's a major impact on a little boy at his bris. And what happens at a bris, for a mother, it's a very difficult experience. A bris is difficult. I've never seen a mother that took it easy, that found the bris easy. Because there's one point, there's one moment at the bris that I think is the most challenging for the mother. And that is where she's holding her baby, having prepared him and he's all ready, and she has to give the baby over to someone. She has to actually give him away. That moment is a challenging moment for every mother. But it's so necessary for the little boy. He needs to be given over to the male ceremony, to be receiving a bris. That she has to realize that he's a boy, not a girl. And so the bond, not the bond has to be severed, but the identity of the child has to be clearly stated as being one of the boys. He has to become a boy. It's a difficult stage, but it's an important one. That stage of the boy moving on to the boyhood world. Then, in traditional circles, there's another moment where the boy actually becomes one of the boys. That there's a tradition to not cut a boy's hair until age 3. Amongst religious communities, the boy's hair's grown, and the first haircut happens at age 3. And what invariably happens is, for the first 3 years, everyone says, "What a cute little girl! You know, how gorgeous!" And, you know, "What a cute little girl!" And most of the time, it's not even worth correcting them. But then at age 3, they get a haircut. They get their short hair, they grow their little payas on the side, and they're given a kippah to wear all the time, they wear their tzitzis from now on all the time. Now you're a boy. One of the reasons for this custom is that it's that age, at age 3, that a child starts to become self-conscious, self-aware, aware of themselves. They start to be consciously aware of their own identity. And so, because this is a boy, we need to reinforce the boyness of the boy. Now you're a boy. So at this age, we do a whole ceremony, a haircutting ceremony, to say that you're a boy, you're identifying as a boy, you're one of the boys. And you see a transformation in boys at that age, when I go through this, that they take on more responsibility as a boy, and their identity really does change and develop. because we recognize that it's not enough just to disassociate from the feminine. He has to associate with the masculine. But that happens when he's aware and conscious at age 3. And then, of course, Bar Mitzvah is exactly at the time, that between 12 and 14, exactly at the time when a boy needs to become a man and be accepted by the men, that's when the Bar Mitzvah comes. That's when the whole ceremony of a boy becoming a man in Jewish tradition, becoming part of a minyan and counted as a minyan, able to read from the Torah and say the blessings, going into the men's shul and being a part of the men, that happens at age 13, and that is an essential stage. I once got an email from a lady who said that she is a single mum and she's got daughters and one son, and he's at Bar Mitzvah age, and she's got a bit of a dilemma as to which shul to have the Bar Mitzvah, because she feels that if she goes to an Orthodox shul where the men and women are separated, so this poor boy is going to be by himself in the men's section, and she the boy's sisters are going to be in the women's section, separate from him, and she feels that even though she is from a traditional background and would go to Orthodox, but she feels maybe to go to Reform, where men and women are together and the family be together, it might be a better experience. I responded to her that I understand the dilemma, and it is very difficult, but she has to remember, what's the point of the Bar Mitzvah? The point of the Bar Mitzvah is this boy becoming one of the men and feeling that he's entering the world of manhood, being accepted by the men. So, and maybe even more in her circumstance than in other circumstances, where this boy is not growing up with a father figure at home, maybe even more it's important for him to be part of the men. Of course, this boy does need a father figure. He needs an uncle or a good friend or the rabbi to take him under the wing and to welcome him into the men's side of the shul. He needs extra support. But the whole point of the Bar Mitzvah is that entering into manhood and becoming one of the men. And it's at that stage, during those teenage years, that the boy then needs to find a role model and a hero. And this is where we have to be very careful. Because if we don't offer heroes and role models to our kids, they'll find them. But where will they find them? They'll find them on MTV, or they'll find them on the internet, or they'll find them in the movies. They'll find people that not necessarily are they the people that we want them to be their heroes. Not necessarily are these the role models that we would want them to look for. But it's in those years, in those teenage years, that there's a desperate need for it. And so we have to make sure that we're directing our children in a way to know who the appropriate heroes are. And the best way to do that is for them to know who our heroes are. Who do we look up to? To tell them stories about great people from Jewish history, the characters from the Torah, or great people from our own families, the stories that we can tell them about people really to emulate. That will send them on the right direction to find the right type of hero. I've emphasized the boy's journey. Of course, there's a girl's journey, but I can't really tell you about that. So for those of us who do have the boys, we should know that it's a very difficult path. But a boy has to become a boy. It's something that has to be acquired. He has to find it, and then he has to become a man. But if we give them the right male role models, so then they'll be blessed to grow up to be good men, good teenage boys, and then good men. And then they really will be able to, when they're solid and clear in their identity of their male identity, they will be able to find their feminine side and find a nice woman as well. I'll end it there.
That was really interesting. Luckily, there's a woman on the panel. A little bit of Kabbalah once read from Rabbi Glazerson is that a man is like a yud and he's sort of hanging up in space, and women are like a hay with our 2 feet on the ground. So that was beautiful and really insightful and very philosophical. But as, you know, relatively easy role as women, you know, this sort of easy life that we lead, there are some practical things that need to be done. So luckily I'm here to give that little bit of practical advice. I'm also going to talk a little bit about development, because it's quite a shock when one of your children become a teenager. I remember when I had small kids and someone was asking me advice and I was sort of giving textbook advice, and she turned around and she said, all this advice, just wait until you're the mother of a teenager. And you know, you always think, won't happen to me, or I'll get it right, or it'll be different. But what happens is you have these kids and then one day you wake up and there's a stranger in the house. You just don't know this person anymore. And I use the cutoff as 10. Some kids are a bit older, some are a little bit more precocious and a bit younger, but it's not even 12 anymore. Kids stay around 10 or 11, have a lot of teenage attitude. One of the main differences is that when children are under 10, they think that we are God. It's actually very nice. They think we can do everything, and it's part of their development for them to feel safe in the world. They think that their mothers and their fathers are the cleverest, the most beautiful, the richest, the nicest, the we just can do everything, the strongest, and we feel, our kids feel very, very safe because we are just omnipotent everywhere, we can just do anything. And then one day they wake up around 10 and say, who is this person? They don't have any answers. They can't get it right. So-and-so's friend's got a better mother, a richer father, a prettier mother, a bigger house. They do things better, and suddenly they're questioning who we are. And we get dethroned, and we get chucked into the situation where we are under fire. Now, the main message I want to give today is you can survive teenagehood. I'm nearly through it all, and I have survived it. But it's not easy. So there are a few things you need to know. It's normal. It's normal for your teenagers to be difficult. And in fact, it's important. And in a way, I think that's what Rabbi Moss was trying to say, that they need to go through these developmental phases to find out who they are. And I sometimes sit with people in my office who are over 40 and are having real struggles with their lives. And I'll say, were you a rebellious adolescent? And they'll say, no, I was always a good girl. I always did whatever my mother did. And so they've never really questioned, they've never really made choices that suited themselves, and suddenly they're 30 or 40 or even 50 and they say, why am I in this life? Why am I doing this? I'm doing this because it made daddy happy, or I'm doing it because it made mommy happy, but that I really want it for myself. So when you have a rebellious teenager, and we're not talking about juvenile delinquents, we're talking about the girl that says, I will dress differently to you, and the son that says, you know, I'm going to go to that party no matter what you think, or I'm going to choose these subjects at school, or whatever it is that teenagers choose that doesn't fit into our agenda or our needs, it's actually an important rite of passage that they actually have that time that they can find those answers. Now, that doesn't mean that you lie down and say, okay, it's over, I don't have to parent anymore, just go out and make your own decisions. We have a very tough role that we still have to guide our children. Because they need to test, but we have to stand firm. And that's really the big thing about adolescents, is they need to go through what they need to go through, but we need to be parents. So often, I think it's a generational thing, that parents today just give in a lot of the time. You want to go and drink? Go and drink. You want to stay out all night? That's okay. You want to go on a holiday with your girlfriend? Whatever you want, darling. I just want you to like me. That's all. I just want to be God again. I want you to think I'm fabulous. And it's not a good thing. It's not a good thing. So we have to do certain things. I also want to just say one thing that relates to what Rabbi Moss says. Boys are different to girls, and they behave very differently in adolescence. The chief difference, there are a lot of differences, but in terms of our interaction, is that boys disappear. They hang out and they disappear. Those are the two things. They're always waiting for something to happen. They're hanging out. What are you doing? We're hanging out. We're chilling. We're waiting. They always have this air of expectation. Something's going to happen any minute. There's, right? Girls argue. So boys disappear. They're either always at their friends or on the computer playing I don't know what. So they war games. I'm not actually sure. They go into this whole sort of... They just disappear. And girls are very present, but they argue. That's the interaction. Everything is an argument. The slightest thing, move the cup, why should I, where, how, so everything's an argument. So there are major differences that you start seeing in how they react. And in principle, it's really important that what I'm going to say applies to both, although their behaviors will be different. So the first thing is you actually, this is where it's hard, Rabbi Moss, to be a mother. You and a father. Why did you forget that comment? Is you actually have to really know who you are and what your values are, because you are going to be hounded and argued with and criticized and put against the wall all the time. So the starting point is you actually have to say, why am I doing this? Why do I believe this? Like, why do they need to come home early? You know, because kids hate hypocrites. Adolescents, hypocrites are like their favorite word. They're such a hypocrite. They do this bad, you know. They tell me not to eat this, but look what they eat. They are right. So you actually have to know, why do they have to go to bed early? Now, it sounds ridiculous. And this is a big difference. When parents discuss everything with two-year-olds, I say they don't need to know why. You don't have to explain to a two-year-old why they need to go to sleep, because they're two. And you know better than them, and they have to go to bed. Teenagers think they know better than us. You know, there's an old joke you probably all heard, but it's, I still find it funny, you know, because I've been through it. Every time my teenagers, I think of this joke. So when a child turns 23, the son turns around and says to his father, gee, you've learned a lot in the last 7 years. So kids actually think they know better than you, and so teenagers want to know why. Why are you telling us this? Because actually we think we know better than you. So you actually have to think about, why am I making these rules? Or why do I run my house this way? Why have I made these choices? And it's often very confronting. And often one has to be flexible to say, maybe I should let go of this. Because you want to keep the arguments to a minimum. You don't want to fight over every little thing. You always want to choose your battles. And maybe you're holding on to something either because your mother did, because you've never really thought it through. So you really need to know, what am I teaching my child? Why am I saying it's important to eat healthy or go to bed early during the week or to do their homework or to wear that certain outfit? Why? Because if you don't really know why you're doing it and it's just a rule, well, rules are meant to be broken. But if it's a value, a deeply felt value in the family, even though your child will fight it at the time, they are digesting it. And when they reach a certain age, they will take it on board. And that's what a lot of what people will tell you who experience. There seems to be this sort of time capsule between 13 and 23, and suddenly around that time, it's suddenly, oh, what my parents said made sense. But if you haven't been stating the value, if you're just saying do what you like, then they're not going to have anything to come to. So that's the first thing, is to be sure about what your values are so that you can impart them. The second thing is not to impart them as rules, but to impart them as values and give up on consequences. Actually, more and more in my parenting, and I do a lot of parenting, I even think of younger kids, forget consequences. They're just a waste of time, and you lose. We lose. We're too soft. We're too, I don't know what we are. We just never fulfill our consequences. Forget them. It's a better way of parenting. But certainly with adolescents, forget consequences. Just state a value. So what you say is, I expect you to be home by 1 a.m. on a Saturday night. And forget, and if you don't, then you're gated. Because you know and I know it's not going to work. And even if you try, they reach an age where they climb out the window, literally. Or they just don't come home and you don't know where they are. So you left standing there, this bunch of floss. You've got no power. So don't give them that. You just say to them, I want you home at 1 a.m. And if they don't come home at 1 a.m. the next day, you push on your tape recorder button and you say, I was disappointed you didn't come home at 1 a.m. I expect you to come home at 1 a.m. And you just reinforce the value. And that way you don't lose face. And sooner or later they take it on board. But don't give consequences, you're going to lose. And they get worse and worse. And you know, you end up taking away everything and you're still there winning. So just forget it. Just state the value. Now, if you need to institute something, and this is very much one of Covey's principles, really involve an adolescent in the decision. So you sit down and you say, listen guys, running this home is like running a business. It's not that we're trying to set rules because we know, because you know, you're nobody in this home. We're a company and we're going to be successful here. And there's certain things that need to be done. And now, and adolescents respond very well to this. Let's talk about it. We're a team. How are we best going to fulfill this? And you might say, a common one I get is chores. This needs to be done. The lawn needs to be mowed. The dishwasher needs to be emptied. The floor needs to be mopped on a Wednesday. These are the jobs that need to be done. How are we as a family going to meet this? And 9 times out of 10, when they're part of that decision, one will say, I will never mow a lawn, but I'm happy to do the dishwasher. And every family is different, but they become part of the decision. And they take it on board. And again, what Kobe will say is that you just set the target. I would like you to empty the dishwasher by Wednesday afternoon. I think from Saturday lunch to Wednesday is a fair amount. Wednesday is my tolerance, right? And then you don't, from Saturday, keep checking the dishwasher. You let go of it. But you, right? And you say, okay, every Wednesday at 6 o'clock, we will check the dishwasher together. So you set a target, and this is called delegation. And these are all corporate principles as well, where you treat people, you know, with responsibility, and then they live up to that. And so you just let it go, and at Wednesday at 6 o'clock, you say, let's go and check the dishwasher, and it's done or it hasn't been done. If it hasn't been done, you say, look, this is not working. We have to rethink it because it has to be done. And you've taken that on board. And generally, if it's something manageable and they're part of taking it on board, after a few times, they get it. But it's about letting it go. It's about not checking all the time and micromanaging. That's really important. There's certain things, and I heard this, there was a guy, what's his name, Greg Carr, the other psychologist who spoke on adolescence. I didn't hear it personally, but apparently he spoke at Mariah a few years ago, and it was told to me. So if I got it wrong, I'm sorry, it's probably like broken telephone, but I thought it was a great idea. He said, in terms of tidy rooms, he said, tidy up your adolescent's bedroom. Make it look the way you'd like it to look. Take a photograph, blow it up, stick it on the door, keep the door closed, and every time you walk past, you see the room of your dreams. I thought it was great. You know, those are one of the things I have met. I think in 30 years I've met maybe two parents who've told me that they have teenagers that fold everything. And but honestly, it's something I hear all the time. You're losing a battle, and it's about just reinforcing it all the time. There is one way of reinforcing it, though. When you do want to reinforce it again, it's about getting people to live up to something. So you don't walk in and say, oh, this is disgusting, you look like a pig, it's hideous, because that doesn't create anything. When you walk in, you just make a comment. Teenagers will respond very well to this. You just make a comment, or you say something like, you know, you take such pride in everything you do. You know, I really thought that you would take pride in your room as well. So they start thinking, gee, I do take pride in things. Or for a girl, you might say, you know, you're such a princess. You always walk with such regality and wear such beautiful clothes. You know, your room could be like a palace as well if you chose. So you talk about it like that, and slowly it actually sinks in. It's really a very big motivation tool where you say to someone, you're a princess, not you live in a disgusting way. They start to live up to that. So you start giving them these cues that they will live up to. And get the photograph as well. Okay. It's very important when your child is going through this difficult phase not to give up on them in your heart. Because often people say the right things, but they give up on their children in their heart. And your children can pick it up. If you're disappointed in them, they feel it. And that's what they live up to. It's really, really important to feel, really trust that this child has the skills they need to move through this phase. And they know, one heart to another knows what you really, really feel. So again, I'll give you a Covey example because I think it's a great example. He talks about his son was a teenager, and him and his wife wanted his son to be great at baseball. And every morning they would get up at 5 a.m. and get their son there and stand on the side and say, go, we believe in you, do it. And the son just wasn't really good. And they said all the right things, and they couldn't understand what was going wrong. And one day he sat down with his wife and he said, what is actually going on? What can we change? What is really happening? We're trying to fix him, but it's not working. And they realized that in their hearts, they didn't really think he could make it. They were waking him up. They were getting him there. They were cheering him on, because inside they didn't really think that he could do it. And so they changed their philosophy, and they actually said to him, look, you take ownership of it. If you want us to take you at 5, we will, but it's fine if you don't. And we really trust when you're ready, if you'd like to do it, you can do it. And once they let go of that and really trusted, it actually turned him around. And I'm not saying overnight, but he did actually become, so you're nodding your head, you know the example, he did actually become a great player. So sometimes we take ownership because we don't really believe it. So we really, really need to believe that our child can get there, and they will pick that up and they will get there. And often we're giving a message, we're saying, go, 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 I believe in you, because really we don't, and we're trying to just be cheerleaders. So that's a huge thing that our kids feel. So what I sometimes say to people when I say, do you really trust that your child will get there, your adolescent, they'll say, no, you know, that purple hair, the nose ring, the drinking, I'm really finding it hard to believe they're going to get there. And then I'll say, well, do you think you got there? And very often they'll say, what do you mean? I'll say, well, are you happy with your life? And often people say, not really. And I'm often surprised, because they're people who are high achievers. They've got, you'd think they've got everything, but somewhere they don't really feel they've made it. And that's a very important thing. Because one of the best things you can give your children is the feeling that you'll get there. I got there, my spouse got there, our whole family's pretty successful, you'll get there. Whatever success means, I don't just mean material success. That kind of trust that it'll be fine. But often if you're really questioning your life and your self-esteem isn't that good, it's hard to give that message, this is just a phase and you'll get there. I mean, often I'll have parents who have children with learning problems, and they're both high-powered parents and they're intelligent and they're doing well. And I tell them, there's no reason statistically your child's not going to get there. It might be a more of a rough route. They might need a bit of extra, but they've got the genes, they've got the intelligence, they've got the tutors, they've got the school. They will get there. 90% of these kids get there. You need to trust that they will. And then I'll say, how were you at school? I was shocking. Did you get there? Yes. So then you can be relaxed about it. And again, from your heart, the feeling is you'll get there. It's just a phase. And that's what your kids will pick up from you. So your own self-esteem is very, very important. And your own self-esteem is also good when they do dye their hair purple, that you don't see them as a reflection. And we all need to support each other in this. Let you reassure, I don't really judge you because your child has got the nose ring and the purple hair. I'm okay with it. Those are my child, I don't need to judge you. But we need to actually have enough self-esteem that if our child is doing something a little bit different, that we're not bad parents, that everyone else is not judging us, that we've got to just go through this phase and they'll be okay. Because often we try and make them be different. You've got to be a doctor. You've got to do this because then I feel better about myself. And then we don't allow them to become, to go through this identity thing in the way that they need to. You really need to have your own life. Unfortunately, so many of us live through our children, and when they want to grow up and they become adolescents and they want to sit with their friends at parties and they don't want to come with us wherever we want to go, and we start giving them a hard time, it's because we don't have a life. We've got to let them separate and come back to us when they need to. So get your own act together, have your own friends, have your own life, have times when you're with your kids. But it is important that you let go and you separate. You know, people have this idea that we're so close. Oh, it's fabulous. We do everything together. And I think, to use South Africanism, shame. Shame. You know, what is this you need each other? You're 30 years older. Get your own life. Let them have a life. See each other twice a week. Love each other. It's not healthy to be so bound up. They can never develop their identities. And those are the girls that are sitting at 40 and 50 or the men and saying, who am I? When did I ever become my own person? So it's again and again it becomes to us having our own lives. Of course, if there's a major problem, you do have to deal with it. Often we go into denial, and there are major problems. There are kids who are drinking too much and drugging and behaving in ways that they shouldn't be behaving. And that's very, very hard as a parent. That's when we go into denial, think it's not our child. Those dilated pupils are from late nights. The friends they're mixing with are not really so bad. If there is a real problem, you do have to do something. Don't be in denial. You have to be the parent. You have to take charge. You have to do whatever there needs to be done. Don't let it go for too long. And it's very hard to live with that disapproval, because when you say to your child, I really know that you're on drugs and we have to do something, and they say, I hate you and get out of my life and you're bad and you're this, we have to say, it doesn't matter. I'm still your mother. I can live with the fact you hate me right now, but you're going for help. And you have to be strong and you have to be the adult, because although they're going through the identity, they're not yet adults and they still need us to be their parents. So we have to give them enough flexibility to have their own lives, but very much be aware of what's going on and knowing when to step in and when not to step in. I'll just finish with a story that I once heard from Rabbi Manus Friedman many years ago when his children were all teenagers, probably in the late 70s, and I always remember it. He told a story about a rabbi that came to collect money in America, let's say from Israel, could barely speak English, but he was a very, very learned man, and he was fetched by some American guy, and the American guy said, you know, it's the early 70s, I don't know what's happened to the American youth. Have you seen what these hippies look like? They're barefoot, they don't work, they smoke pot, they live with each other, they're not married. What's going to happen to the world? He says, no, a fog. Say, thoughtful, this guy doesn't speak English. He repeats the whole thing. These people have no morals. They're traveling all over. They're evading the draft. I don't know what to do. What's going to happen to America? He says, no, a fog. So the guy starts telling him a third time. He says, No, I understand everything you're telling me. He says, it's a frog. I'm not good at accents, and I'll go back to my own South African accent. Turns around and he says, look, have you ever thought how a frog feels? A frog has babies, they're little tadpoles. They swim in the water, they look like little tadpoles. The frog is green with legs, jumps in the water, out the water. It looks at its progeny and says, who are these people? They don't look like me. They can't come on land. What did I produce? But sooner or later, the tadpoles turn green, they grow legs, they hop out the water, and they become frogs. So you need to hold on and be the best frog you can be. And sooner or later, your tadpoles will be frogs.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Renee. Thank you, Rabbi Moss. It's where's Jody? I think we found a great venue for the Thursday morning class. don't worry, I'm just joking. It's great. It's a really, really great feeling to be here today. First of all, thank you, Melanie, for agreeing to be the MC. I know it's reluctantly, but thank you. And it's just really beautiful to begin the process of the celebrating the 10th anniversary of Vina. I was looking yesterday at something, at a site that provided a definition of a teenager, and it said a teenager is a girl who goes into a clothes store and says, I would like to return this outfit because my mother likes it. You know, parenting is a journey. It's a journey that we start all the way from the beginning. Starting from the beginning, I also read that there was a grandmother who had a birthday, so the grandchild calls up the grandmother to wish her happy birthday, and the little grandchild says, the little boy says to granny, she says, Granny, how old are you? Granny says, I'm 62, actually. So there's a moment of stunning silence, and the kid then pipes up and says, did you start at one? So we do start at one, and it's a journey, but the teenage phase can be a challenging one. It's a unique period in that journey, but it's also a period that can be overwhelming, can be challenging, but can also be a great opportunity. It's an opportunity that we shouldn't miss. It's an opportunity we shouldn't misuse. So there's so many different aspects. Rabbi Moss touched on a very unique angle of teenaging boys. We just heard the practical strategies. I want to just spend a few moments, because I want to leave time for questions as well. I want to just spend a few moments on one aspect of parenting teenagers, which I think is so important and so critical. And I think it's very often overlooked. And what I'm going to say is based on the works of Daniel Schoenbuch, Rabbi Daniel Schoenbuch, who wrote a book on teenaging. He's a rabbi in America who deals, as a counselor as well, he deals with teenagers at risk. And he talks about the relationship theory, the concept, the importance, but not only the importance, the power, the amazing power of using the teenage years to bond and to connect with our teenagers and to develop a relationship with them. Teenagers are mini children. They're mini children too. But they're mini adults. They're not like four-year-olds, not like five-year-olds. They're developing. They're kids, but they're really maturing. Last night I said to my teenager, I'm now parenting my fourth teenager, a couple more to go. It's not getting easy. Each one. I don't know why. I thought I'd be such an experienced guy by now. Anyways, so I said to listen, I gotta give a talk on teenaging tomorrow. What do you think I should say? She says, tell them teenagers are not stupid. Anyway. But our teenagers are sometimes childish, but they're very mature. Their intelligence are developing. And teenage years, in fact, a great opportunity to actually develop, to invest time, to invest effort in developing a relationship, a bond, a connection with our teenage children. Now, it doesn't mean that we need to become their friend. Those of you who come on Thursday morning have heard me say many times that particularly in Jewish tradition, in Jewish wisdom, there's a hierarchy. A teacher is not a friend, the parent is not a friend. There's respect, there's a hierarchy of respect, but it does, and we have to respond to inappropriate behavior and antisocial behavior in a proper way, and we've heard some great tips, but it does mean that we keep the role as a parent, but at the same time, we work on developing that connection, developing that relationship. And the research is very clear. There's studies done in this in the States. The research is very clear that developing a healthy relationship with our teenagers leads to better academic outcomes, leads to more balanced emotional children, less psychological distress. All of the better self-esteem, all of these wonderful outcomes are linked to building solid relationships with our teenagers. Now, this concept is overlooked, and it's difficult. And it's difficult for various reasons. It's difficult because sometimes during the teenage years, we're so busy navigating and trying to survive the rules and the boundaries and how to respond and which boundary to insist on and which battle to pick and which war to fight. And we're so busy sort of managing their behavior that we forget to take off time and we forget to use some energy to invest in developing that relationship. Secondly, it's very difficult to build a relationship with someone that's totally unpredictable. Teenagers, we know, are totally unpredictable. One day they want to talk to you, the next day they don't want to talk to you. One day they're in a good mood, the next day they're not in a good mood. Actually, it's not in one day, it's like sort of in 1 hour. Right? It's like in 1 hour, it's a bit like the Melbourne weather. You know, it's like the first 10 minutes they want to be your friend, the next 10 minutes that you're crazy, leave me alone. It depends, boy, girl, different reactions. But it's very difficult to build a relationship with someone who you don't know what, you cannot gauge their reaction, you don't know how they're going to respond. And thirdly, sometimes with more challenging teenagers, and there are challenging teenagers because teenaging is challenging years, and some are more challenging than others, but sometimes teenagers tend to make themselves very unlovable. They tend to put themselves into a corner where it's almost impossible to have a relationship with them, because what happens is, because they're semi-adults, and because sometimes our own self-image, our own self-esteem, our own security is a bit on weak ground. We're insecure. Our self-esteem is a little bit weak. It's different to five-year-olds. You know, when a five-year-old turns around and speaks to you and screams at you or doesn't do what you ask him to do, most of us, I hope, don't take it personally. It's a five-year-old. But it's not so with teenagers. When a 14, 15, 17-year-old turns around and gives it to you, we start to take it personally because we look at them a little bit as people who should have more intelligence, should know better, they should be able to make some choices. And when they argue, we tend to build a faribul with our own children. You know what I mean? We tend to sort of get insulted and hurt by our own children, which is a crazy concept. But we do that and we create that distance. And therefore, when they all act sort of in a very disgusting way, then the next morning it's very difficult to love them and to give them a hug and to build a relationship and connection with them. But what we need to bear in mind is two critical rules. One rule is that all teenagers need that relationship, and specifically the teenager, and I think this is so important, specifically the teenager that makes life difficult for you, specifically that teenager who you think has made it their life goal and life mission to drive you crazy, okay, that is the teenager that is crying out for a relationship. That is specifically the teenager that is craving that connection. And that's the teenager that needs, that's most difficult to relate to, and that's the teenager that needs it most. Rule number one. And rule number two is that we as parents have to develop a very unique ability to forget. What I mean is this. So it's nighttime. You know, teenagers tend to make themselves heard. They sort of enter a room and everyone else has to sort of dance to their tune, right? So a teenager walks in, boy, girl, trips their younger sibling, knocks their baby out of the way, scream, you know, I'm hungry, wise, you know, you only got leftovers. Every time, every Sunday night, there's leftovers. You don't know how to cook, you've forgotten how to cook, it's disgusting this food, I can't eat it, I'm going to starve. And then they threaten, I'm going to die of hunger. And poor Jewish mother thinks, oh no, I don't want to die of hunger. And you really think, by the way, that if they go to sleep hungry, they're going to die of hunger. They're not, by the way. There's great scientific research that actually people can do without food for a night. And in fact, they don't die of hunger. Okay, it's a very... Anyway, they act disgusting. You turn, you say something. You don't know what to say. You say, they turn around, they say, you're the sickest mother I've ever had. All my friends' mothers let them do this and let them do that. They abuse you. They swear. They insult you. Right? And you're falling apart. The next morning, they've forgotten about it the next morning. Completely forgotten about it. They walk in. They walk into the kitchen. Either they're in a good mood.
Yeah.
Hi, Mum. What do you mean, hi, Mum, you disgusting brat? What do you mean, hi, Mum? You know, you're not going to... Like, you think to yourself, I'm not talking to you. You're going to have to apologize for last night, right? Or they don't say, hi, mum. They walk in like grumpy, like, you know, they just haven't woke up. It takes some teenagers a few hours to wake up. They walk in sort of 3 seconds before you need to take all the kids to school and say, like, where's my lunch? No. So here's the unique ability that we have to develop. The night before, when they do whatever they do, when they act inappropriately, we've got to have a strategy to respond. So it's about being firm, it's about being assertive, it's about learning all the parenting strategies that we need to learn. But when we've dealt with the behavior, however we've chosen to deal with the behavior, and we've heard some great tips before, and there's more, of course, is a topic that it's not dealt with in 10 minutes, it's probably a lifetime learning lesson. But when we've dealt with the behavior, we need to be able to put it to a side. We need to be able to put it to a side, and when they come down the next morning, or the next hour, or the next minute, we have to be able to give them a hug. We have to be able, not to condone their behavior. We've got to respond to bad behavior, we've got to encourage social behavior, pro-social behavior. But we've got to also be able to talk and schmooze and give them a hug and smile and say, how was your day? And have a good day, even though inside we feel we're still suffering from the night, from the last night's experience. They've forgotten about it, but they need that relationship. They don't need to be approved. The behavior doesn't need to be approved of, and we have to deal with it separately, but they also need that relationship. So we have to deal, we have to develop that ability to forget, deal with things, box it in, put it aside, and then move on and work on developing that relationship with your child. So very briefly, Daniel Schomburg talks about, hey, I've lost my notes. Here we are. He talks about the three C's of a relationship. That's what a very, very it's a complex topic, but very, very briefly, and then I'm going to conclude and we'll go for questions. But very, very briefly, he talks about the three C's of relationship. And the three C's of relationship are connection, control, and communication. Connection means, first of all, to learn how to connect to our teenagers. Learning to connect to our teenagers means two things. First of all, it means learning to start understanding their world. We need to understand, in general, relationships always is about understanding the other person's world. Teenagers' world can be very different than ours. We need to understand where they're coming from. We need to understand why they like certain things that we don't like, why they want to do certain things, why they want to go off in certain tracks that maybe we don't understand. Understanding them, when we understand them, they feel understood. But connection also means, and this is something that I think we don't do enough of and we don't do in any relationship, but particularly with our teenagers, connection means spending time. Spending time together. Now, of course, not when they don't want time, as we just heard, but sometimes they do want time. Just doing things together, finding things that they like, mutual interests, spending time, schmoozing, not lecturing, instructing, educating, putting them on the right path, but just spending time. More of it, the more the better. Going on trips that they want to go on together, cooking together, visiting things together, talking together, whatever they want to do, whatever you can get them to want to do, depending on the day, depending on the minute, depending on the week, but spending time together, just bonding. It's different to small children. Sometimes we think teenagers just want to do their own thing, and they do for the large part of it, the most of it, but they also crave a relationship, because that relationship is an investment which we can reap the benefits of later, but it comes through understanding them and spending time with them. The second C is the control. Control means to learn to give up control, to learn to change from what he calls direct control to indirect control, to mentor, to, as Renee was saying, to state your values, but not to control, because we cannot actually control teenagers the same way that we control seven-year-olds. And the second, and the final thing is communication. Communication has two parts. The way we communicate with teenagers is so vital, because first of all, we know that a large part of communication in any relationship is listening. Now, again, those who come Thursday morning would have heard me say many, many times that active listening means when you listen to someone and you don't think of your response while they're talking. I don't know if you've ever tried this. It's a very difficult thing to do. Most of us, when we listen to someone or we say we're listening, even if we're nodding our head, we're actually formulating a response as people talk. Listening means to shut down when someone wants to talk and to just listen so that I connect to your world. I connect to what you want to say. I understand what you are saying. When you've said it and I've absorbed it, then I can formulate a response and I can tell you where my world is. But communication is more about listening than it is about speaking. And we need to reflect in terms of our teenagers, even the difficult ones, do we just sit down and listen to them sometimes? Not always to offer information. You know, you say, how was your day at school? All right. But sometimes they do want to talk. And when they talk, we need to listen, but really listen. And the other part of communication is that even when we need to be firm, and even when we need to lay down the rule. And even if we do need to give a consequence, or if we don't give a consequence, or we need to be very tough, whatever the case is, but we need to do it with respect. Even little children, but teenagers specifically. Teenagers hate to be embarrassed. Teenagers hate to be insulted. They're people. And therefore, he says there are 10 commandments. He talks of the 10 commandments of relationship, of communication. First of all, he says, thou shalt not. Thou shalt not insult, judge, blame, insinuate, or embarrass. These are things that teenagers absolutely hate. You can be assertive, you can be firm, but we can be disrespectful. They're people, even if they're very challenging. What we do have to do is, we do need to compliment appropriately, accept them for what they are. We need to encourage, we need to empathize, and we need to always find the good. Finding the good is so important, because there's a lot of good. Even with the challenging teenagers, you've got to catch them when they're good. You've got to be able to connect to the good in them. So these are the three C's of building a relationship. Connection, control, and communication. We also need to discipline them. We need to manage their behavior. But the more we invest in their relationship, the more we invest in bonding and connecting with our teenagers, even when we don't see the response, and this is the challenging thing. Normally with adults, when you relate to someone, you get it back. Teenagers, often you don't get it back. Or it doesn't seem to get it back. But it's an investment which you reap the dividends later. Later, when they're 22, 23, 25, that's when you see the benefits of the relationship. If we love our children unconditionally, we accept them, we manage their behavior properly, but we accept them at the same time, we love them and we relate to them, we were able, hopefully, the home is always an anchor where they come back. The home is always the anchor where they relate to when they're adults. And if they felt loved, if they had a positive teenage experience, hopefully they reconnect and come back and the connection lasts for many, many years.
Thank you. Time for some questions.
I want to know about the fourth C, which no one's really touched on, which is consequences. Because you basically said if they do something wrong, it's restating the value. Do you not believe in consequences? I mean, where do you draw the line if there is some kind of consequence or punishment or...
I suppose if the consequences can be carried through, then there's a place for them. But with a lot of testing teenagers, you can try and implement consequences, but what can you do? I mean, you can try and take away pocket money. I've seen parents try and do that. They just go and get a job. They'll say, I don't care. You can try and take away their phone. You know, what are the consequences going to be, and what are the consequences that you teach them? So what I'm saying is, if you think the consequences are really going to work, then they have a place. But most often they don't work, and you left actually with egg on your face. And so unless you're really sure they're going to work, and you will still be holding some level of dignity and control, then try and implement them. But on the whole, many things, it's not worth it.
If behavior is unacceptable to you, and no respect, whatever, it's just unacceptable to your day-to-day life, you have to do something. You can't just say, well, it's too bad, this is the way he speaks to me.
No, you're saying to them, I expect you to speak to me nicely, or you might say, I'm not going to stay in the room while you talk to me like that. Those kind of consequences that you can be in charge of. And that's probably one of the most effective ones. If they're being rude, you say, I'm leaving the room now, and I'm ready to talk to you when you speak to me nicely. But if you're going to say, if you're rude to me, you're not watching TV tonight, or I'm gating you, those kind of consequences don't really work. So you can only do consequences that are going to work and that you have some control over.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You touched on earlier about... the way you feel about yourself and the relationship with your kids, and things like hypocrisy, and it's okay for the adult to do it, but not okay for the teenager. Could you just talk a little bit more about that?
We live in a world where more and more, even young children, don't do what we say. They do what we do. So there might have been a generation where if dad said don't smoke, we didn't smoke, even though he was smoking. Even young children today will look at what you're doing rather than what you're saying. So if you eat unhealthily yourself, or you're overeating, and you're telling your child, while you're eating a cream cake, don't eat that, you'll get fat, it's not going to get very far. So what I teach a lot, and that works very well, is it's not a criticism. We all have our weaknesses. Is that sometimes it works very well to say, look, I struggle with calories, or I struggle with smoking, or I struggle with being tactful, or whatever our thing is. Let's work on it together. That works much better. but you have to be able to do that. So many, many things, you know, we tell our children not to lie, but we lie all the time. We might think we're not lying, but we're cheating the tax man, or we're telling our kids to tell people we're not there when we are. But just yelling at them for lying, they pick that up.
Swearing
is a huge one, you know. I've many times had mothers sitting with teenage daughters, actually more daughters than boys, and saying, you know, my daughter swears terribly. And I'll never forget once I said to the mother, do you swear? And she said, no. And the 12-year-old said, rubbish, you do. And she said, only in the car. So, you know, I would love, you know, yes. Doesn't, you know, so you have to say, it's fine. What? How do you teach your child not to swear when you have allowances for yourself? So teenagers are very, very subtle to that. They watch your behavior all the time. And it's better sometimes to say, I'm struggling with it too. I know it's hard, but I'm trying to aspire to it, than to try and lecture and say, you can't do this when you're doing it yourself. You know, respect me, but I'm not speaking to my mother. That's another very common one. You better treat me well, I'm your mother. Tell Granny I'm not home. I don't want to speak.
What do you do sort of in a situation when your child's telling you stuff and you can, as you said, you know the answer, well, not that you know the answer, but you really kind of want to give them the advice and how to deal with it, and then they say, but you're not hearing me, you're not listening, but you already know what they kind of are going to say, and the argument comes up that, do they not actually want your advice or response? Do they just want to tell you?
I'm not sure if I understand the question 100%. So you're talking about situations where they're offering information.
Well, they're actually telling you a situation and they appear to want advice or help. And you're already ready to dive in and give them the advice and the help from your worldly so-called experience, but they don't actually, you don't get...
So there's two things. First of all, I think sometimes they don't want your advice, they actually just want you to listen.
Yeah.
And even when they do, they only want your advice if they feel secure that you've really listened. So you've got to demonstrate, listening generally, you've got to demonstrate that you've really listened, which means, I mean, there's all kinds of techniques, I mean, not just technique, but real techniques in terms of how you demonstrate active listening. I mean, you've got to be able to be quiet, you've got to listen. Sometimes it helps to paraphrase, to repeat what they've said. So you're telling me that, so and so and so. Ask them what they think, so how did you feel about it? And then you gauge it, and once you can see that they feel that you really understand them, you're really listening, then you can say, well, you know, my feeling is so and so, but only once they really feel that you've listened. Sure.
I'm not sure who wants to answer the question, any of you really. I find it really hard to deal with the whole barrage of emotion. You know, my daughter can come home from school, and it was the worst day in the world, and this is terrible, and anything you say, she's so negative. And I don't know how to handle all that emotion. So what can you recommend?
I think my answer really, which started with this, is that generally people don't want advice. And it's actually an interesting question from a woman, because it's one of the classic men are from Mars, women are from Venus differences that are given, that we women want to just unload on our husbands and they're rushing in with advice. And sharing is just a big part of communication. So that's the first thing, is to know that unless a sort of a general rule, someone actually asks for advice, I would say the rule of thumb is don't jump in with advice. But really just be there, I would say, as a container to really contain the emotion. And being a container means not to be caught up in it, just to be calm and sort of just holding. So in the same way you would physically hug someone, it's like an emotional hug. You just listen without feeling the pressure to solve it, because you trust in your heart that your child has skills. You've really taught them for 10 or more years. And the second thing is that if you calm, they will feel held. So it's just about listening and being calm and knowing what Rabbi Garari says, that it could last for 5 minutes or an hour. Don't be afraid of emotion. A lot of them are very afraid of emotion. We want to fix it. But emotion is good. Sometimes a child needs to cry, they need to vent. As long as they're not being abusive to you or their sibling or whatever, and they're just venting, that's fine. And you just be a container. You don't immediately, if they say, you know, my friend was mean to me at school, you say, never going to happen again, I'm phoning the school. And you also get caught up in it and you're as emotional as them. You're not being a container. You just listen and you nod, and then you might make a comment like, you know, it does happen a lot, or you're feeling really down today, but you don't just say, I'm going to fix it, or we're going to do anything.
How do you teach them that they can't sort of go through life just screaming and shouting and bursting into tears about everything?
You teach them by being a container yourself. Mm-hmm. They need to go through it, just like the times that you need to go through it. Mm-hmm. We don't have to jump in and teach them every moment. So you are the role model of being the container, and the way that you behave most of the time is what's going to teach them. Don't get alarmed, because it's about just being there to hold them through the feeling, and they will actually move through that quite quickly when you're okay. But you have to understand that sometimes, like when your kids have really major problems, let's say they have a social problem at school, there is no way of fixing it, and they don't want you to come and tell them, maybe you should try this, and if you were nice to the friend, they would be nice to you. Sometimes they just need a safe place that they can come, and you give them an emotional hug, and you just listen. And just by being there, that's actually the starting point in listening. Is that we get very anxious about fixing our children's problems, and we can't always. And really, 9 times out of 10, they come home the next day as if nothing happened. They fixed it themselves, and they just needed you to be that calm container.
Can I just make one comment also, just in terms of how you... If someone's responding inappropriately and emotionally, you want to train them how to respond to something, because you ask, how do you teach them? They can't go through life doing it. One of the, I guess only from experience, one of the most powerful techniques that I've learned as a parent, I think, is that when a child gets angry, always disrespectful and very anxious, or emotionally exploding inappropriately, you never deal with it at the time. Even if you want to deal with it, even if you think it's important to deal with it, at that time, just to be, as Renee said, a container. If you do think it's that important to deal with, you need to wait for the next day, when they've calmed down, have a talk to them. You remember yesterday? This is what happened. This is how you responded, and let's work it through. Maybe you can role model and role play. This works even with small children. But in fact, it comes from a Mishnaic passage in the Ethics of the Fathers, Pirkei Avot, that you never try to appease someone when they're angry. Right? Because when the emotion is happening, it's useless to try and deal with it then. If anything, it's after that.
Can I just say something as well, though? This is the commercial for Emmet. The group that I run on Wednesday mornings, 9 a.m. at Bina. What's very nice about it is the 4-step program on how to manage emotions. And whenever a new person comes to my group, they say to me, how can I teach my husband not to be angry? When I drive with him, he has road rage. How do I teach this? How do I teach that? And what I say over and over again is, don't worry about them. You just work on you learning how to do it. Being a woman and being the pivot of the home, what starts to happen is that everyone else starts picking up your tools. And one thing that works very well is if you verbalize what you're doing. So when you feel you're getting emotional and you know a tool, let's say, you know, this is going to pass, or this isn't important, this is a triviality, one of the Emmet tools. So you're sitting in traffic, which is, you know, and you actually say, I'm not going to get upset, this is not a major thing, it'll be okay, you verbalize it. What you will find, again, maybe not between 16 and 18, but suddenly your children start repeating that back. It's like a shock. One day you're in a situation and suddenly you hear them saying, you know, this isn't life-threatening, this is a triviality. So by you role modeling, that is the biggest way of facilitating everyone around you. Nobody likes to be lectured to. Kids think you're moralizing and lecturing, and you don't understand them anyway. You're a different generation. That's how they think. But you role modeling it seeps in, and there comes a time they use it themselves.
Rabbi, talk about children's bedrooms. Now, everything is literally in your face. Facebook, MySpace. Yeah, Mom, look, they're consumed by it. A lot of kids and teens are consumed by this. There's no limits on it. There's no limit who their friends are or who can befriend them. Is it possible to impose limits? Does one not want to give up on that altogether?
I think it's very important to impose some limits. But yeah, you're right. That now it wasn't like it used to be. Maybe a generation ago, where you had to go out to be in somewhere to get yourself in trouble. Now it all comes to you, and it's all available. And so I think it's interesting. In Jewish law, there's an idea of yichud that a young person shouldn't be alone in the room with somebody else that could do something wrong with. You know, like a young boy and a young girl shouldn't be left alone in a closed room. So some have suggested that the same applies to a computer, that children shouldn't be left somewhere where they can do whatever they want unwatched on a computer. It should all be visible, and obviously this has to be age appropriate, where they develop a trust that you can trust them, you know. But in I think in early stages it has to be more supervised, and you can get things on the computer that limit which websites they're allowed to go on, or they can't even go on the computer alone when they're very, very little. You sit there with them and make sure they're going to the right things. And then as their trust is built, then maybe they can do more alone. But to just leave it up to them, I think is a crazy thing to do. It's like sending them out to the streets.
Cool. We'll take one more question and then okay.
When you've got a 15 and 16 year old son and daughter, and they come home and they're doing homework, and a lot of homework's done on the computer, and you often go into the room and check, which I do on it, and it's limitless for them, and you can't concentrate them either. It's almost like it's the same thing that Brenda, you were saying, that you've got to give your kids, you've got to let go a little bit. So it's a bit of a mixed message. I'm not sure.
Well, yeah, it's true. I mean, it would be very hard to start when they're 15 or 16. But if it started when they were much younger and they know, and they also have to know the message. It's not, sometimes we think that because, you know, we have it in our mind, we don't actually tell them what we expect of them. If they've been told that, you know, the internet is a very powerful tool, it's very useful, there's a lot of good things on there, but there's a lot of bad stuff there as well, and I want you to be responsible, and tell them exactly what the dangers are. You know, I don't want you chatting to somebody and, you know, just going onto this website or that, but if you at least told them that and reinforced it, and, you know, then they have the guidelines. They can't expect it to know themselves.
I just want to make a comment. I'm not saying no limits. I'm saying no consequences. So what I mean by that is, if you say you can watch TV an hour a day and then we're unplugging it, rather than, if I catch you watching TV, then you gate it. Because
yeah.
That's when you lose. When you say, we don't believe you should be on Facebook for more than 10 minutes, and you set it up in place, and you state your value and expectation, that works much better than catching them and then trying to punish them. I'm not saying no limits. I'm saying you have to know what you believe and enforce it in your home in that way. Mm-hmm. If the consequences don't work after the fact.
There might be some more questions, but I think we're still going to hang around, so if anyone wants to come over afterwards. I just have your attention for 1 minute just before you go. Before everyone enjoys some delicious food. Just to make just a few concluding remarks. First of all, we have a bit of a problem. Right, just give me 2 minutes there. The problem is that we were given, at the office, we were given strict instructions not to thank today's host. So without mentioning any names, I want to give a very, very huge thank you to the host. I was going to say Jody in my notes, but then I said my life for them. I just want to say that it's really inspiring that when we started the process of arranging and organizing the events to celebrate Vinna's 10th anniversary, how many people were ready to help, and today's function, Lana and Jody and so many other people, and all the other functions that we're about to celebrate in the next few days. And I just wanted to mention a couple of things. First of all, that of course next Wednesday night, I'm sure most of you have seen the adverts at the Australian at AJC, the race course in Randwick, going to having the major celebration event. With a very interesting and inspiring guest speaker, Shimon Fogel, the head of the Canadian-Israel Committee from Canada. The Israeli ambassador is also going to be there, and it should be a wonderful evening. It's a dessert buffet, and it should be a very, very enjoyable evening, and I urge you all to come. Today also was a little sample of the type of stuff that goes on in Binah. Of course, there's lots more. There's Rabbi Moss's Tuesday night Kabbalah class. There's my Thursday morning lecture for women. There's Renee's Emmet, and many, many more classes. And if I can just ask all of you on the way out, if you haven't yet given, if you're not on our mailing list, just give us your email and we'll put you on the mailing list so we can keep you up to date with all the programs that we run. Just give us your contact details and your email and we'll put you on the list so that we can send you the email, send you the updates. Once again, thank you all for being a wonderful, wonderful audience and being the audience of the first celebration event. And we're going to invite everyone, and a big, big thank you to... I'm also going to go against instructions now, but a big, big thank you for this function, all the functions, to our office staff, it's Blumi, Karen, and Nakama, who's running away. A big thank you to MC Melanie, and please enjoy the delicious lunch.
Could I just say one thing, please? If anybody hasn't yet paid, could you please just fix it up at the financial
entrance? Athena, 45,000 euros, yeah.
Make sure you go to Athena on the way out and you'll be up there with all the way out.